funding has been agreed upon for each lawyer. Then I'm going to show you how we're keeping time. Some of you may have been here since we started our exercise with remote oral arguments, but I want to be sure everybody is up to speed and is comfortable with what we're doing before we begin. And then I will call the case. So to begin with, we have, let's see, Attorney Firtholz, you have 20 minutes. Then Attorney Essenberg, you have 10 minutes. Then Attorney Schreiber-Jurs, you have 40 minutes. And at the end, Attorney Firtholz, you again have 10 minutes rather than 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that what you all are expecting?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Very good. Then I will show you how we're keeping time. Our marshal will hold up time cards. When it's time to start, you'll see a green start card. When you have 5 minutes to go, you'll see a 5 minute card. And then when it's time to stop, you'll see stop, and it's a red card. I will hold you to the red card, except if you are in the middle of answering a justice's question, I will always let you finish the answer to the question. So when you have just 10 minutes to argue, the time is going to go by very quickly and your 5 minute card will come up very quickly. So I'll try to help you along with that because I know it's hard to be concentrating on your argument and you don't have our usual friendly lights in front of you to blink at you. So I'll try to help you with the cards as they come up if you seem not to notice them. Since we are all assembled, then I will call our case for the morning. If I could get rid of the frog that I seem to be carrying around. Fabick versus Evers. Are you ready to proceed, Attorney Firtholz?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Matthew Firtholz of Kramer, Multoff, and Hammes, appearing on behalf of the petitioner, Jerry Fabick. The issue before the court is whether the governor of Wisconsin must respect the 60-day limitation on the exercise of his statutorily conferred emergency powers. Although the legislature explicitly reserved to itself the authority to extend a state of emergency, Governor Evers has conferred on himself the right to declare successive states of emergency for the same public health emergency. Because Governor Evers premised emergency orders 82 and 90, which are the second and third emergency orders, on the same public health emergency justifying the original declaration, these orders represent an unlawful end run around the legislature's 60-day limit on the exercise of emergency powers. This court should declare these orders unlawful and void.
So, counsel, it's your position then that the governor, under the statutory section 32310, can only declare one state of emergency in the midst of a disaster or public health emergency. Is that what you're saying to us today?
If the legislature does not grant an extension beyond 60 days, that's correct, Your Honor.
And you're then conflating the terms state of emergency with public health emergency, right? Because of the way I read the statute, it talks about if the governor determines a public health emergency exists, he or she may issue an executive order declaring a state of emergency. So you're conflating public health emergency with the state of emergency as if they are all one and the same.
Respectfully, no, we are not, Your Honor. We are relying on the statutory definition that the governor cited to in his emergency order declarations.
Definition of public health emergency, which describes an occurrence, correct?
Correct. The governor labeled COVID-19 a public health emergency under 32302 sub 16. And we agree with him that COVID-19 meets that definition.
All right. And you're relying on this idea that there can be only one in the midst of a disaster or public health emergency that could last obviously more than 60 days. You rely on the fact that it talks about the extension of that state of emergency, right?
That's correct. That's how the statute reads, Your Honor. Yes.
You can't point to anything in the statute that talks about only one state of emergency or anything that describes what, in fact, what kind of facts there may be to be the state of emergency, right?
The statute reads, a state of emergency shall not exceed 60 days unless the state of emergency is extended by joint resolution of the legislature. And by the text of those emergency orders, Governor Evers declared a state of emergency based on the exact same public health emergency. So by the terms of the orders, the March, July, and September declarations all relate to COVID-19. And so to extend it beyond 60 days, he needs permission from the legislature.
So, Council, what does that mean as a practical matter? Does it mean that after 60 days, all emergencies cease, or does that mean that there is public protection, but the public protection comes from the governor and the legislature working together?
Your Honor, after the original 60-day emergency order expires, the governor can go to the legislature and seek an extension. And the legislature is allowed to grant an extension of that state of emergency. That has not happened here. So the governor's state of emergency could not exceed 60 days. The governor still has tools at his disposal. He has emergency rulemaking authority under 227.24. Those emergency rules last 150 days. But here the governor invoked his powers under the statute, which gives him broad powers. And if he's going to rely on that statute to assert emergency powers, he must comply with the statute. And here he did not. He did not seek or receive an extension from the legislature beyond 60 days.
So if I hear you correctly, there are at least two other avenues to pursue additional public protection, but they involve the legislative branch and the executive branch working together, or rulemaking to occur, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Does Council, let me just follow up on that, and then I have another question. Does the governor have rulemaking authority?
The governor, through his cabinet secretaries, does. Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, but the governor, as the head of the executive branch, per se, doesn't have rulemaking authority, does he? I mean, that's not a power of the governor.
It's a power that he exercises through his cabinet secretaries, Your Honor.
And there are specific statutes that give the power to the different agency heads, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, what I really want to get into, though, is the coronavirus and its definition. I understand that the novel coronavirus is SARS-CoV-2. Is that your understanding, or don't you know?
That sounds correct to me, Your Honor. I don't recall the exact definition, but that sounds correct to me, yes.
Now, let's say this current difficulty with SARS-CoV-2, the novel coronavirus, abates. And 2 years from now, but not completely, just like a lot of illnesses, polio, we thought we had it, and then it comes up again. So let's say it abates, and 2 years from now, SARS-CoV-2, the novel coronavirus, rears its ugly head, and we have a resurgence of a pandemic. Is it your position the governor then, having once exercised authority on this novel coronavirus, no longer would have the authority to issue an emergency order declaring a public health emergency?
That is not our position, Your Honor. And the reason is, if you look at the definition of a public health emergency under 323.02 sub 16, it refers to a virus that is novel or previously controlled or eradicated. So if coronavirus were to be controlled or eradicated but came back, it's certainly possible the governor could declare a state of emergency and meet the definition under that statute. Of course, that's not what's happened here. No one's claiming coronavirus or COVID has been controlled or eradicated. In fact, the governor's orders refer to the presence and the spread of COVID, later the growth of COVID, the need to contain the presence of COVID. So those facts aren't before the court, but it is possible that if the virus were under control and emerged in a number of years, it could still meet the statutory definition of a public health emergency.
Is it your position, Council, that the statutory interpretation in this case really focuses on the issue of how you define occurrence?
That's part of the analysis, yes, Your Honor. We believe this is a single occurrence, and we are not taking issue with the governor's decision to label COVID a public health emergency under the statute. We agree it meets the definition. The problem for the governor is it met the definition in March, it met it in July, and it met it in September. And for him to issue those second and third emergency order declarations, he needed approval from the legislature, and he didn't receive it.
So, counsel, following up on some of the examples that my colleague, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, asked, if it did not abate, and it has been with us for a long time, the way that you're defining occurrence, let's just say, hypothetically, all of our hospitals are overrun, which actually is literally happening, and we get to a point where there needs to be action taken. It's your position that because one emergency was issued, one state of emergency, based on an ongoing public health emergency or public health crisis, that the governor could do nothing in terms of declaring a state of emergency because the hospitals have been overrun, which could be another occurrence, correct?
Well, if we're dealing with a targeted scenario of a short supply of hospital equipment, the governor could issue a separate order that is targeted to the specific problem. But that's not what Governor Evers did here.
He declared I need you to tell me what the difference is then. It sounds like because he laid out different facts within each order. So now you're saying it's more of a fact-finding issue and something that perhaps shouldn't be in front of this court as to what is an occurrence and what is not?
No, the question before the court does not involve or does not require factual finding. The governor has labeled COVID-19 a public health emergency. We acknowledge that it meets that definition. For him to keep Wisconsin in a state of emergency, which again gives him all sorts of broad powers, he can seize private property, he can suspend administrative rules, which he has done before, to invoke that power, he needs approval from the legislature, and that did not happen here.
Okay, so tell me again about the hospitals. You were about to say that somehow he could issue, when our hospitals are overrun, he can issue something. I don't see how that works under your framework.
Well, if he's claiming that there's a supply of medical equipment that's in short supply, and that represents a disaster, it's conceivable he could issue an order separate and apart from executive orders 82 and 90. But these were broad orders that just declared we are in a state of emergency. The entire state is in a state of emergency from COVID-19.
Okay. I don't see how you can do one or the other. Your logic on that, I don't follow at all. These broad orders did very limited things, just like a hospital supply issue or issue with overrun hospitals would be similar. I don't see how, I don't follow how the governor has any authority to do anything under your reasoning.
Well, the governor had authority to declare a state of emergency. We do not take issue with the first declaration. It meets the definition, but to keep Wisconsin in a state of emergency from the same underlying conditions, he would need approval from the legislature. And what's presented before the court, we have three emergency declarations all stemming from the same statutory definition. Those are the powers the governor has referred to and invoked. And he is not allowed to continue to keep Wisconsin in a state of emergency without approval from the legislature.
So, Mr. Fernholz, you just said the phrase, the same underlying condition. Let's talk about the underlying conditions and the state of Wisconsin when the first order was ordered, and then the change that happened between that and Executive Order 82. You agree with me, don't you, that between the first order in March and the second one that was signed in May, that the numbers in this state increased significantly, right?
Just a point of
question. The number of people who had contracted COVID-19 had increased significantly in that time period, right?
Just a point of correction. The second order was issued in July.
I'm sorry. Thank you. So, I'm sorry, July.
yes, the numbers had increased. The numbers are going to go up or down on a daily basis. That doesn't justify a new emergency or a new public health emergency.
Well, I'm using your words, and your words were the same underlying condition. And the same underlying condition to me would mean that the numbers would at least, at best, stagnate. Hopefully they would go down. And you would agree with me that between the order that was issued in July and the order that then the governor signed in September, that again, the numbers went up exponentially in that period, right?
The numbers did increase, and the governor issued a third state of emergency order while the second one was in place. It is all stemming from the same public health emergency, and there is a statutory definition. If the governor is going to claim these powers under the statute, he has to comply with the statutory definition. And the definition is, if it's a virus that is novel or previously controlled or eradicated. COVID-19 has not been eradicated. It's not been controlled. It was novel in March when the governor issued his first emergency order declaration. It is no longer novel now. So
under what definition is it no longer novel? Who's saying that?
We have been living with COVID-19 for 8 months. The World Health Organization declared it a pandemic in March. And this issue came before the Seventh Circuit on a question of Wisconsin election law last month. There was a request by plaintiffs to change our election laws on the grounds that COVID-19 was a last-minute event. And the Seventh Circuit rejected it and said Wisconsin has been dealing with this for 8 months, conducted two elections in COVID. It is not a last-minute event justifying a last-minute change. That's correct. COVID-19 is been impacting our state for 8 months. So it still meets the definition of a public health emergency. And if the governor wishes to extend it, he needs approval from the legislature.
Mr. Fernholz, on that logic that you just told me, I want to know on what date between last January or February when we started to hear about this and today, COVID-19 pandemic no longer was novel. What date was that?
Your Honor, the point is that when the governor declares COVID-19 to be a public health emergency the first time, if he wants to continue declaring states of emergency related to COVID-19 under the statute, if it is still the same public health emergency, which it is, he needs to get approval from the legislature to extend it beyond 60 days. So we don't, again, we are not challenging the first emergency order declaration. There are certain circumstances, I suppose, where a governor could declare a state of emergency for a virus that would not meet the definition. We are not challenging that here. We agree with the governor. It meets the definition of a public health emergency. And it met that definition in March. The legislature did not revoke it. And so when the 60 days expired, if the governor wanted to go beyond that 60 days for the same public health emergency, he would need approval from the legislature.
Mr. Fernholz, I understand that, but we're looking at this definition and the word novel is hugely important. And there is no vaccine for this virus. There is no way to stop this virus. How, other than the Seventh Circuit saying that we've been dealing with this for 8 months, I mean, to none of us does it feel novel because we have been, our lives have been uprooted because of it. But I don't understand. Are you using a medical term? Or some sort of medical information that you have that this is no longer novel? If this isn't novel, then I'm not sure what is.
It is novel, and that's why the governor's first declaration was acceptable. But as this court held in Palm, a pandemic is a single occurrence, and emergency powers cannot last indefinitely in a pandemic, which will last month after month. And so for the governor to continue citing to COVID-19 and saying, well, it's still here, it's still present, so I can declare a state of emergency. No, you can't. He's promoting an interpretation of a statute that grants him power, even when he admits the statutory requirements do not exist.
If the Center for Disease Control is still calling this a novel coronavirus, does that have any effect on your argument that it's no longer novel?
No, the point of citing to the definition of novel is no one, I don't think, could challenge the governor's emergency declaration in March. It met the definition. But the statute is clear. Once the 60 days expire, the governor needs to seek approval from the legislature to extend it beyond those 60 days. So we are not taking issue with the first emergency order declaration. If someone wanted to argue that coronavirus wasn't novel, the time to do that would have been in March when he issued the declaration. It met the definition. And so once it expired, the onus is then on the governor to seek approval from the legislature to extend the state of emergency.
I have difficulty understanding why your definition of the virus should trump the Center for Disease Control's definition. They still call it the novel coronavirus. As of what I looked at 3 days ago, still calling it the novel coronavirus. So it perplexes me. Let me ask, how do you quoted paragraph 41 of the Palm decision. How do you interpret the couple of sentences before what you quoted? Constitutional law has generally permitted the governor to respond to emergencies without the need for legislative approval. So constitutional law has generally permitted the governor. You're saying, but specifically here, it's not permitting, we're not going to allow for that. How do you deal with this broad statement of constitutional authority for the governor?
The governor did not invoke his constitutional authority when he issued these emergency declarations. He invoked his statutory authority under Chapter 323. And if he's going to invoke that power and cite to the statute, he has to comply with the statute. And here he is not. And as to the argument that coronavirus remains novel, that's the point, Your Honor. It was novel and it met the definition. You don't get an unlimited amount of emergency declarations for the same public health emergency. So that is our point, that it meets the definition. It met it in March, and it is the same public health emergency that he continues to invoke and rely on his emergency powers. This is a very...
To address the fact that there is also in this statute of ability for the legislature to shut down the emergency at any point in time. It could meet the day after the governor declares it and say we're ending it. How do you address that point and the fact that the legislature has done absolutely nothing here?
Yeah, you can answer Justice Dalit's question.
When the governor makes that argument that this is a political question for the branches of government, that flips the statute on its head. The legislature could come in and have voted down the first emergency order declaration, no question. They didn't do that. And so it lasted 60 days. It was valid. Now what the governor is saying is, I can violate the statute. I can violate the law. Taxpayers aren't allowed to challenge me. The judiciary is not allowed to review this. Instead, the only remedy for my violation of the statute is for the legislature to convene in special session and vote it down, even though these orders, in our view, are void ab initio because the governor had no statutory authority. So this flips it on its head. It is not for the legislature to convene in a special session and say, we do not approve of the governor violating the law. The governor is the one that needs to seek approval from the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Attorney Essenberg, are you ready to begin?
I am. Thank you, Chief Justice. As a preliminary matter, the Lindu amici agree that the statute does not permit the governor to declare emergencies in series related to, as he concedes, a single originating cause. He has, if an emergency arises, 60 days to make law, to rule by decree. During that period of time, he could convene the legislature. He could seek additional authority. He could, as this court pointed out in Palm, both during that period and after, make rules and even issue orders that do not qualify as a rule under the guidance that Palm provided in response to a public health emergency. But he only has 60 days. The statute makes this clear. If the statute did not make this clear, then the legislature would have delegated a core legislative function, the power to make law, to the governor with neither substantive limitation There is no particularly legislative guidance or, if the governor is right, no meaningful temporal limitation and no adequate procedural safeguard.
Counsel, in light of your time, I have a couple of questions I wanted to explore with you. My first question is, I know you're not making this argument here. I understand your argument is sort of an in the alternative on statutory grounds, but if the statute is read as petitioners and you agree it should be read, do you see any non-delegation problem with the statute as construed that way?
Well, there's a potential non-delegation problem in that the I don't believe that the legislature could allow a state of emergency to extend indefinitely. Let's assume, as may well be the case.
Yeah, I was saying just assume there is a 60-day limit and that the position that you take is correct. Do you think there's any non-delegation problem assuming that the state of emergency in this case should have been limited to one 60-day term?
I could have been clearer. The point I was trying to make is that if the legislature under the statute essentially allowed the state of emergency to go on indefinitely by extending it, that would create a non-delegation problem. I would hesitate to go too far in opining on whether or not the absence of legislative guidance, even during the 60-day period, could constitute a non-delegation problem. But the point that we want to make here is that it is certainly possible for the legislature, under certain emergency conditions, to allow the governor to act during a period of time in which the legislature cannot convene. But the point of the statute, and we believe it is a constitutional requirement, is that at some point we must return to constitutional order, because to read the statute in any other way and to permit this type of delegation would flip our constitutional system on its head. It would invert it from one in which the legislature makes the law, subject to executive veto and potential legislative override, to one in which the executive makes the law, subject not even really to legislative veto, but to legislative reclamation of its constitutional authority, but only...
Mr. Essenberg, let me ask you a question. Has there been any time that you know of between, let's say, March of 2020 and now, when the legislature has been unable to convene, as you just said?
No, the legislature has been able to convene.
And certainly the proposals that you have on page 21 of your brief, where you say that that the governor could propose legislation and the legislature could to the legislature to deal with the problem, or the governor could ask the legislature to extend the state of emergency past 60 days. All of those, of course, would involve the legislature actually convening, correct?
Yes.
And the statute itself that we are talking about actually gives the legislature quite a bit of power, doesn't it? The legislature can put an end to one of these emergency orders of the governor, correct?
It could.
It could extend it, correct?
Could do that, subject to
the legislature could convene. They could write a whole new statute, couldn't they?
They could do that.
So the legislature actually has a lot of power here, should they choose to use it.
Yes, but with respect, I think when we're talking about the separation of powers, it's important to understand that powers are not separated for the benefit of those who exercise them. They're separated for the benefit of the people, both as a bulwark to protect liberty, but also as a safeguard against the concentration of power that can lead to things like regulatory capture and the error that often arises from too narrow decision making. And so the point here is, you know, one could criticize the legislature for not acting in some way that the legislature desires or for not rescinding the state of emergency. But The controlling point here is that the legislature doesn't get to abdicate its authority. I mean, this court recently in Tetra Tech took back, whether by constitutional command or by judicial policy, its obligation to make law. The legislature has an obligation. It may not give away its constitutional authority. And the problem with Section 323.10, if it has read to have no effective temporal limitation where emergencies can be declared in series, is that it amounts to a legislative conferral of its power upon the governor for an indefinite period of time, inverting, as I said, our constitutional system.
And counsel, under the Constitution, the people of Wisconsin actually conferred that legislative power on the legislature, right?
That's right. They did so under Article 4, Section 1. I also would make reference to Justice Rogensack's decision in Palm, where she explains that our liberty is protected by the requirements for the passage of legislation, the requirement of a quorum, enactment and presentment, an open body. And so it is one thing to say that we can dispense with those things for 60 days. It is another thing to say that we can dispense with them indefinitely, particularly given the capacious definition of what constitutes a disaster or a public health emergency under the statute. It could be almost anything.
When do we reach the point of indefiniteness then? Because here the legislature is actually under 323.10 giving its legislative authority to the executive branch to deal with an emergency, and that conferral of legislative authority on the executive branch is to span 60 days. We're at the 8-month mark. Has the legislature abdicated its responsibility to the people of Wisconsin to take the power that the people conferred on it back from the executive?
Well, I would always say that each branch of government has the obligation to safeguard its core constitutional responsibilities. This court does and has done so, and the legislature does as well. I think certainly that argument could be made. But for our purposes here today, I think the point is that the statute itself places a limit on the governor's ability to act in this way. It says I'm sorry.
Counsel, I wanted to ask if your argument is correct, the argument you're making on the non-delegation doctrine, what would be the remedy that you would be seeking here? Ordinarily, it seems to me like in most of the cases dealing with this historically, that the remedy is that the statute is problematic. And I'm just curious what your thoughts would be on remedy here if your argument is correct.
If our argument is correct, and if the statute is read in the way that the governor asserts that it ought to be read here, then I believe the statute is facially unconstitutional. There should be a declaration to that effect, and the emergency declaration would be rescinded. It would then be for the governor to act under Chapter 252 if he can, and to the extent he can, and the way that he can, and the legislature and the governor both to return to regular constitutional order with respect to their response to the COVID pandemic.
Mr. Estenberg, go ahead, Justice Dowd.
Can I ask one more question?
I think his time is up.
Okay.
Right. Okay, so I think it's not a good time to start, but thank you. We'll now move.
Thank you.
Okay. Attorney Juris, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please do.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Hannah Juris, and it is my great privilege to appear before the court today on behalf of Governor Evers. As this court well knows, Wisconsin is currently waging its toughest battles against the COVID-19 pandemic. But the issue before the court is not simply, this is not simply a COVID-19 case. The question before the court implicates the governor of Wisconsin's ability to address any emergency circumstances that may befall our state, whether caused by war, flood, fire, or as here, a viral pandemic. And given the significance of the matter before the court, I would like to start with two overarching points that should inform how this court navigates this case. First, in navigating the case, caution signs appear before the court at every turn. This court should take those caution signs seriously because emergency response necessarily involves complicated, fact-based determinations that rightly rest with the political branches. Most significantly, the plain language of 32310 itself puts a big stop sign at the very first step in the analysis. And this court should recognize that by the plain language of the statute that the legislature has written, the propriety of a governor's decision to issue a state of emergency order rests exclusively with the people of Wisconsin as a whole through their elected representatives in the legislature, not with an individual and respectfully not with this court. But if this court nevertheless proceeds further, it should heed the other caution signs that appear, caution signs against abandoning principles of statutory interpretation, against deciding constitutional questions based on hypotheticals, and against wading into non-delegation waters based on questions of degree.
Counsel, your briefing and your statement just now suggests that there's no role to play for this court in this dispute. But of course, you would agree we're not considering the propriety of the governor's actions as a policy matter. We're looking at the extent of his legislative grant of authority under a statute, and that is particularly within the competence of the court. Wouldn't you agree?
The propriety of a governor's decision to issue a state of emergency order under 32310 it is not a question that is properly before the court. And the reason it's not is because the legislature has told us in the plain language of the statute that this question does not belong to the court. But to be clear, Your Honor, on exactly what we're saying is non-justiciable. If an individual believed that any emergency measure that a governor takes pursuant to his decision to push that alarm button, which is what's at issue here, then an individual would be fully able to bring a challenge to that particular measure. And this court would, of course, have the competency to hear that determination. But the only issue that's before the court today is the propriety of the governor's decision to push that alarm button.
Counsel, has the National Guard been deployed in response to the orders that these two orders that have been issued?
Yes, Your Honor, the National Guard has been deployed and has assisted with such matters as ensuring that the November election was safe in light of the pandemic.
Wouldn't the expense of the National Guard at the testing places and the election be sufficient to confer taxpayer standing on the petitioner in this case?
So I'll agree with Your Honor that this court has before recognized that taxpayer standing doesn't necessarily have to be a particularly high amount of money expended. But I think what's particularly important here is that where the plain language of the statute tells us that the propriety of a governor's decision to issue a state of emergency order belongs with the people as a whole, it would be improper to instead allow that determination to be made essentially through one taxpayer and the court.
In the Palm case, counsel, the executive branch took the position that the legislature did not have standing to advance those claims. And now in this case, the executive branch is saying, no, it should be the legislature. It shouldn't be a taxpayer. If we look at those positions and try to reconcile them, there would be no individual or entity to challenge the exercise of the governor's authority that was given to the governor by the legislature under a statute.
So I would respectfully assert that those address different questions. And the reason that this particular question of pushing that alarm button is non-justiciable is because the legislature itself has told us so in the plain language of the statute. And with regard to the Palm question, the issue in Palm concerned the Department of Health Secretary's actions under a statute that the legislature wrote. And so I think the propriety of the legislature having standing to make a challenge before the court under the under concerning the actions that DHS took under its statute is different than an individual's ability to challenge the governor's decision to push the alarm button.
But the decision to push the alarm button was made back in March, and there is a 60-day limit in the statute. I don't understand how the 60-day limit in the statute would ever come into play if we accept the governor's interpretation of 323.10.
So the 60-day limitation, Justice Bradley, is doing important work. It's just not the work, the one-and-done work that FABIC suggests. It prevents long-term authority being invoked for a short-term emergency. It, for example, prevents a governor from issuing a 365-day state of emergency order for a wildfire that may only last 2 weeks. It also, as the circuit court recognized in the Lindu case, ensures that if a governor determines that emergency conditions are still present such that he needs to issue a new state of emergency order, that he's doing so based on a current emergency, based on a snapshot of facts that are present in Wisconsin now. And I think, Your Honor,
I'd like to give you, the way I'm thinking about some of this case in a big picture, I'll give you an opportunity to respond about it. And forgive me for my analogy, but I'm a parent to five children, so this is the way I think about a lot of things. So my nine-year-old son, I don't let him use my phone, okay? And suppose I said to my son, listen, if there's a rainbow that shows out back, you can use my phone, but you can only use my phone for 10 minutes unless you have my permission to use it longer. And to my 15-year-old daughter, I said, you can use my rainbow. You can use my phone to capture the rainbow, but only for, but you can use it for as long as the rainbow is there. It seems to me that this statute looks exactly like that. If you look at the power given to the governor in 10 and the power given to local governments in 11. And if my 9-year-old son came back to me and said, well, Dad, I know you said I could use it for 10 minutes unless you gave me permission to use the phone longer. But I use it for 20 minutes because the rainbow is still there. I would tell him, that's not what I said, that, you know, you're grounded or something like that, right? Give me an opportunity to respond to that, if you will. Why am I looking at this the wrong way?
Sure. So I would say, Justice Hagedorn, that in your analogy, the rainbow is a cause underlying emergency circumstances. But there's the difference between the underlying cause of emergency circumstances and emergency circumstances themselves. And our statute recognizes this distinction, but FABIC's position does not, right? His argument is that the governor has issued multiple state of emergency orders, all for one cause, i.e. the COVID-19 pandemic, or in your hypothetical, the rainbow. But that's not the unit of measurement that our statute uses. And so to back up a little bit, I think it's important that the court look at 323.10 sentence by sentence to really see what it's doing. It's the first sentence of 323.10 that tells us when a governor may issue a state of emergency order. And what that tells us is that a governor may issue a state of emergency order when he determines that an emergency arising from a disaster exists. So, and I'll come back to the definition of disaster, but what's important is that that tells us when he may issue a state of emergency. So then later, the second and third sentences then tell us what agencies he may designate as the lead to respond in particular types of emergency circumstances. And then the fourth sentence contains the 60-day limitation, but what we see is that it's the 60-day limitation on a state of emergency, i.e. the particular order that the governor has recognized exists. And we see that because the language that the statute uses is a state of emergency, and the first sentence tells us that the governor may declare a state of emergency via order.
But counsel, going back to my example here, my instructions to my son about his phone use when a rainbow appears seem to implicitly acknowledge the fact that the rainbow might exist longer than 10 minutes, particularly since I told my daughter she can use my phone for as long as the rainbow is there. I mean, and here you have the local government that has the power to issue a state of emergency for such time as those conditions exist or are likely to exist, and then an explicit limitation of time period as it relates to the governor, which would, I mean, to me, I don't know how you read the statute and don't acknowledge that the emergency conditions can exist, but the governor's power to act via state of emergency, which is a fairly broad grant of emergency powers, rolling back administrative rules, priorities and contracts, doing whatever is reasonable and necessary to secure persons or property. Those are broad, extraordinary powers that it seems like the legislature wanted to only allow for a very short period of time when you compare those two statutes.
Sure. So 2 points. First, with regard to your comparison to 323.11, I think we're really looking at apples and oranges there. And if you look at the language of 323.11, it's not referring to a state of emergency. It's referring simply to an emergency. And so given the fact that we're only talking about what a local entity of government may do, I think it's reasonable that the legislature would say that a local entity may allow conditions like that to continue or allow that particular order to continue, even if the emergency circumstances aren't there. But with, as Your Honor noted, the state of emergency order that a governor may issue, we're talking about something that may be statewide. And this is where I would go back to the unit of measurement that our legislature has used. There is simply no way for the court to draw the one and done interpretation that FABIC suggests without conflicting with the unit of measurement that our legislature has chosen, because the legislature has said that the governor may issue a state of emergency order when he determines that an emergency arising from a disaster exists. And a disaster is statutorily defined as an occurrence. And so I think whether we're looking at emergency or at occurrence, both reflect an event, but one that may be one in a series of events. And just to give an example, and this goes back to the difference between, I think, the underlying cause, that being the rainbow in your hypothetical, Justice Hagedorn, and the existence of emergency conditions. If, let's say, a foreign enemy declared war on the United States and Wisconsin was under the threat of an attack from that enemy in March and a threat of an attack in September, I think we would all agree that emergency conditions exist in March, and emergency conditions exist in September, even though those conditions are caused by the same enemy, and even though the war may not have ended in the middle. And the same is true here. And to build on that, when we look at the orders that Governor Evers has issued, the orders have not been, as FABIC suggests, simply static orders responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. Look at Executive Order 90, which is the executive order that's currently in place. While I know it may feel like a long time ago at this point, in August, Wisconsin's COVID-19 rate of spread was actually slowing. We were feeling pretty good. People were confident that schools would be able to reopen without issue, that universities could reopen without issue. And then the school year started and boom, our numbers skyrocketed, driven for the first time by 18 to 24-year-olds, and Governor Evers issued Executive Order 90 in response to those emergency circumstances, not to a stagnant or static COVID-19 pandemic.
Council, the issue isn't whether or not the government as a whole has the powers or should exercise powers given an ongoing pandemic situation like we have facing the people of the state of Wisconsin. The question is, who gets to exercise those powers? And I understand your argument to mean that the governor, under your argument, is in the best position to address the pandemic. And as long as the pandemic exists, it is and should be the governor who responds to it. But that suggests that the legislature has no competency to respond to a situation like the pandemic, even when it's been going on now for months.
So the legislature, also does have competency, and if the legislature importantly disagrees with the governor's decision to issue a state of emergency order, it may revoke the order at will. And it doesn't have to give a reason, it just may do so. And so
right.
I think
the petitioners are arguing in this case that the reason this case is here is because if the legislature did revoke one of the governor's orders, he could simply reissue the order declaring another state of emergency. And that's why the case has come to the court, so that we can interpret the statute. Would you agree that there is a role for the court to play in interpreting statutes? That's in fact a core role for the court to play.
So I would agree that if the legislature exercised its statutory safeguard that it has reserved for itself, and then the governor immediately thereafter, in an attempt to circumvent that massive procedural safeguard, immediately issued another order on the same grounds, then I think the legislature would have standing, a la the standing that this court recognized in Panzer, to bring a claim against that particular act, not the statute itself. But the legislature could then make an argument that that particular action of the governor was an intent to work around that important procedural safeguard. But I would stress that that's not the question before the court. The legislature has not used its important safeguard if it believes that the governor improperly pushed that emergency button. And this court has said for over 100 years that it is not going to decide constitutional questions, particularly important separation of powers questions, based on hypothetical abuses of power. And so I would urge this court to focus on what is in front of the court, and that is simply the question of whether the governor properly pushed that alarm button.
I don't think that's all that's before the court, counsel, because we do have that secondary issue related to the non-delegation doctrine. And so I'll pose the same question to you that I proposed, that I posed to Professor Essenberg, which is, has legislative inaction for the last 8 months constituted an unconstitutional delegation of legislative authority to the governor, given the 60-day limit on the governor's exercise of power under a state of emergency?
No, Your Honor. And just to break that down in a few subparts, first, of course, it's our position that the 60-day limitation cabins a particular order, but it does not in any way limit the governor's ability to recognize when emergency circumstances are present. And so if I may just give a brief example there, and then I will come back to further answering your non-delegation question. Let's say that there is a flood, and the governor issues a state of emergency order in response to the flood. It's day 50. Things are looking good. Both the governor and legislature think there's going to be no further problem. But then, whether it's on day 59 or 61, new rainfall happens and the flooding resurges and a dam breaks, right? There is nothing in the plain language of the statute that says that the governor could not look at those emergency circumstances and recognize that there is an occurrence that constitutes a disaster that creates an emergency. So turning back with that to your non-delegation question, Justice Bradley, we're in the world of shared powers. Emergency response is constitutionally not exclusively a core legislative function. And I think Mr. Fabick's argument and the Lindu plaintiff's argument sort of goes into a non-delegation autopilot of assuming that this is just core and exclusively legislative. But that's incorrect in the world of emergency powers. And because we're in the world of emergency powers, what that means is the question before the court is whether the 323, as it is set up, unduly burdens the legislature's role. And the answer to that question is a resounding no, because the legislature has reserved for itself the ultimate decision-making power.
Let me stop you there, counsel, because I want to get back to the assertion I hear you making, which is that the governor has emergency powers under the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Where in the Constitution does it say that the governor has emergency powers related to a pandemic situation? Because I'm looking at Article 5 of the Constitution, Section 4, which somebody cited in a brief in this case, and it says that the governor shall have the power to convene the legislature on extraordinary occasions, mm-hmm. and in the case of, among others, the prevalence danger from the prevalence of contagious disease at the seat of government, he may convene them at any other suitable place within the state. So I understand that constitutional power that the people gave the governor to be somewhat restricted into convening the legislature somewhere other than, in this case, the Capitol.
So the governor's authority, shared authority with the legislature in times of crisis, comes from the provision that you just referenced in Article 5, Section 4, but other provisions as well, all of which, when taken together, show a tilt towards the executive in times of crisis, particularly with regard to the upfront determination. And
Counsel, what other provisions in the Constitution give the governor emergency powers in a pandemic?
Yes, Your Honor. Article 5, Section 1 vests the executive power in the governor, and it is hard to think of something that is more inherently important of an executive function than reacting in times of crisis.
Well, hang on a minute, counsel. Are you suggesting that the statutory provision that we're considering in this case, 323.10, is not a legislative conferral of power on the governor? I'm not following your argument.
So emergency response constitutionally is shared authority between the executive and legislature.
Where does it say that? I mean, I understand in times of war, there's particular reference mm-hmm. in the Constitution that that gives the governor some authority in that arena. But this, while we are waging a war on a virus, it is not a war in the traditional sense of an invasion, right?
So right. So it's the executive. The vesting of the executive authority in the governor, taken together with Article 5, Section 4, which, as Your Honor noted, makes the governor the head of our commander-in-chief in times of war, but also makes him in charge of managing the business of the state, both civil and military. And it requires him to take care that the laws are enforced, including in times of crisis. So those things taken together...
Right. It gives the governor the power to enforce the laws in times of crisis and really in times of non-crisis, but it does not give the governor the authority to make the laws. That resides with the legislature, right?
You're right, Your Honor. But what we're talking about here, well, first of all, what we're talking about in terms of what FABIC is actually challenging is that upfront determination to push the alarm button. FABIC has not made any specific challenge to the governor. Any orders or mandates that the governor has issued pursuant to 323.12. But to your point, Your Honor, when the governor does issue an order under 323.12, that's not forward proactive legislation. That's reacting to the particular emergency circumstances. But of course, the legislature has a role too. And so our point is really that this is shared authority. It lies in the borderlands or the intersection of the executive and legislative role.
When the governor presses the alarm button, are there any limits on the powers he may exercise in the name of the pandemic?
Well, do you mean constitutionally or statutorily? Because statutorily, we know that the legislature retains the power to disagree with him and terminate the order completely.
I'm talking about the substance of what the governor may do. I'll give you a more concrete mm-hmm. example. A few months ago, this court invalidated the order issued by one of the governor's cabinet secretaries. Mm-hmm. Could the governor reissue that order under your interpretation of 323.10? Could the governor reissue that order under that statute and in the name of his authority?
So I think it would depend on the emergency circumstances to which the governor is responding to.
The current circumstances that to which he is responding, as you've outlined them in your brief.
So there would be important limitations on the governor's ability to do something like that. And there are three big limitations that I'll set forth. The first is that any action the governor takes under 323.12 must be directly responsive to the emergency conditions that currently exist. 323.12 is not carte blanche for the governor to issue any sort of order related to any sort of subject as he sees fit, right? It has to be a direct response. Second, any order that the governor issues under 323.12 4 sub B must be something the governor deems is necessary. And I understand that the statute leaves the determination of what is necessary to the governor, but necessary is a strong word. It means not just something that the governor thinks would be ideal, but it has to be necessary. And the third point I would say is that the other provisions of 323.12 sub 4 also place some limitations on what the governor may do pursuant to the broader provision of 323.12 sub 4 sub B, which allows him to issue orders that he deems necessary. And by that, I mean this. Another provision of 323.12 sub 4 says that the governor may suspend administrative rules if strict adherence with those rules would impede emergency response. And this court earlier this year held that that meant that because there is that specific power enumerated, the governor could not under sub B take an action suspending a Wisconsin statute. So I would say that all of that works to limit what the governor may do under 323.12.
Counsel, I want to interject. How do you interpret this court's statement in the Palm case that constitutional law has generally permitted the governor to respond to emergencies without the need for legislative approval? Do you interpret that to be a core power or a shared power statement regarding a governor's ability to respond to emergencies?
I think it's the recognition that the governor has a particularly important role constitutionally in the upfront recognition that emergency circumstances exist and pushing that alarm button. And ultimately, whether this court views that as core or shared, the bottom line is that either way, we're not talking about an exclusively legislative function. And so what that means is that the question becomes, is the legislature's role unduly burdened? And the answer has to be no, because the legislature has the final decision-making say.
Talking about the safeguards analysis, I understand that. What about the response regarding the debt? I like to go to the statute. Mm-hmm. I like to stay with the statute and stay with the words of the emergency order. It's your position, as I understand it, that each order is based on a separate occurrence, even though the underlying cause may be the same. So that takes us right to the statute, doesn't it? The definition of occurrence. And the definition of occurrence includes, and we see that in sub 16 of 323.10, and the word novel, and we've had some discussion about what novel means in 16A. How do you interpret the word novel in that specific subsection?
Sure. Well, novel is modifying the term biological agent. So whether the court wants to apply, view the word novel in its common ordinary meaning, or if the court wants to view it as a technical term, either way, it's modifying biological agent. It is not modifying executive order. And so when we say novel in front of a biological agent, the common understood meaning and the technical understood meaning is a biological agent to which humans have not before been exposed, such that we don't have a meaningful response. And as Your Honor pointed out during Mr. Fabick's argument, the CDC is still recognizing that the coronavirus that we are facing is novel, and that is because we don't, at this point, have a meaningful response to it. But I would all...
Go ahead.
Oh, I would just also point out, Your Honor, that the word novel and this whole discussion about the definition of public health emergency is not what defines when a governor may issue a state of emergency order. The first sentence of 323.10 tells us that a governor may issue a state of emergency order when he determines that an emergency arising from a disaster exists. And then the second or and third sentences of 323.10 tell us which agency the governor may designate as the lead agency to respond in particular emergency circumstances, not when the governor may issue a state of emergency order.
Counsel, your opposing counsel defines novel, it appears to me in reading their brief, as not new. It's no longer new. And that's a use of the vernacular. Does it make a difference whether or not novel coronavirus, and as you indicate, novel, and what's the words used, biological agent, I guess, is a novel biological agent? Quite frankly, I had to make sure I knew what a biological agent was. So it must be technical because I looked up biological agent, and of course it includes viruses, right? Not just bacteria and fungi. And does it make any difference? His response is, hey, it's not novel. It's not new. It's been around now since early part of the year. Is that a distinction without a difference, or does that, whether you use the vernacular or apply the technical term, does that result in any difference in the approach of the interpretation of the word in the statute?
So I don't know that it makes any difference, because the definition of public health emergency is not what defines when a governor may issue a state of emergency order. But that's what Fabick is arguing. He's saying that the governor has issued multiple orders responding to one cause, i.e. the COVID-19 pandemic. But beyond that, Your Honor, I would also assert that his interpretation, if correct on novel, would lead to absurd results. And of course, this court doesn't interpret statutes in a way that would lead to absurd results. And by that, if novel means brand new, as I believe it was Justice Kurofsky asked counsel for Fabick, when would it not have been new, right? Governor Evers did not issue Executive Order 72 until March, and the world was aware of the of COVID-19 before March. So returning to the plain language of the statute, I think it's important that the court consider the absurd results that would flow from Fabick's one and done interpretation. And of course, this court interprets statutes in a way to favor, this court favors an interpretation that is consistent with statutory purpose and disfavors one that is not. And Fabick's one and done interpretation not only is nowhere to be found in the statute, but it would lead to results that directly conflict with the statutory purpose.
Counsel, let me just interject. Page 17 of your opposing counsel's brief, I like your one and done. That is clever, whoever came up with that. I'm not saying it's correct. I'm saying it's clever. Anyway. The definition on page 17 regarding novel from your opposing counsel indicates, and it was novel only in March when the governor issued Executive Order 72. What are the ramifications of that?
Well, I think that suggests that novel is modifying executive order, but novel is modifying biological agent. And so if the court looks at, as Your Honor noted, biological agent has a specific definition in 323.02 sub 3, and that includes an agent that is a virus, bacterium, fungus, or toxin under a specified list that is federally created. And so I think if the court accepted a view whereby novel meant a one and done response, that would mean that as long as a governor has issued one emergency order responding to that particular biological agent, even if the biological agent 60 days down the road, 90 days down the road, rears its head and kills many more people, the governor would not be able to issue an executive order responding to those emergency conditions, even though those emergency conditions would meet the statutory definition.
If we're going to talk about statutory purpose, then one could read into the statutory purpose the fact that there is a 60-day limitation, which is designed to allow the governor to exercise extraordinary powers during a 60-day period so that there can be an emergency response to something like the pandemic. But thereafter, it falls to the legislature to pick that up and either work with the governor or allow the governor to continue to exercise those powers or to act as a body in and of itself, right?
Well, I would respectfully assert that there's nowhere in the statute that says that the 60-day limitation that cabins a particular state of emergency order quantifies or limits when a governor may recognize that emergency conditions exist. And one thing I think that we have to be mindful of here is that emergency conditions don't necessarily work in predictable ways. So going back to the war example, if the United States were at war and the state of Wisconsin were under a particular type of threat in March, and the governor issued a state of emergency order, that doesn't necessarily mean that either the governor or the legislature would have been able to fully anticipate all types of threats that could come from that enemy moving forward. So the answer...
I'd like to, make a structural argument here for you to consider and respond to. When this sort of predecessor to this statute was first written in 1955, where it dealt with military affairs. And of course, I would note that the statute says that in order to accomplish coordination when you have a disaster, the legislature feels it necessary to confer this power upon the governor. And then it said, when the governor finds a disaster due to an act of war is imminent or has occurred, he may proclaim a state of emergency and shall call the legislature into special emergency session. Mm-hmm. So you may declare a state of emergency, and then you have to call the legislature into session. 4 years later, in 1959, the legislature removes the shall call language and adds in a 60-day time limit. Mm-hmm. Structurally, the way it looks to me is that the ordinary course of the way the state responds to important things is through passing laws that are passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. But the legislature is here acknowledging there may need to be short-term emergency responses before there is the ordinary constitutional way to deal with things, which is passing laws in one house, then the other house, and the governor signs it. So I have a hard time with the argument that, it leads to absurd results. It certainly handicaps the governor in terms of the way he may respond, but that's because the governor only has powers he's given by the legislature. The governor's job is to execute the laws. So the governor doesn't normally have the power to suspend administrative rules. The governor doesn't normally have the power to shut down roads to secure persons and property or do extraordinary sorts of actions that maybe in extreme situations could be contemplated by this. This is an extraordinary grant of short-term power to the governor. And so it seems to me that it's perfectly consistent with this grant of power that the legislature ordinarily gets to make the policy decisions and the governor has to execute them, whether the governor likes them or not. And again, nobody's questioning the governor's sincerity in trying to do what he thinks is right here. But he can only do what the power he's been given to do, right?
So looking back to that statutory history, Your Honor, and Madam Chief Justice, if I may finish by answering.
Yes, you may answer his posed question, sure.
Thank you. Looking back to statutory history, Your Honor identified that the legislature used a measurement of an act of war, and then when it amended the statute in 1959, it talked about enemy action, and it defined it as any hostile action, not one per war, any hostile action. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that if Wisconsin were attacked on one day and the governor declared a state of emergency order, that particular order is limited to 60 days. But if on day 59, 61, or 90, a new attack occurs, there is nothing that should limit the governor's ability to recognize that that new attack has occurred and issue a new state of emergency order. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Attorney Fahrenholz, are you ready for rebuttal?
I am, Your Honor, yes.
Please begin.
Thank you. I want to pick up on a point that Attorney Jurst raised regarding this court's role and the role of the legislature in responding to Governor Evers' action, because it is really a breathtaking assertion of executive power. The governor is taking the view in this case that, well, maybe I violated the statute, maybe I didn't comply with it. No citizen may challenge it in court. Courts have no role to play in reviewing it. As he argued in the Palm case, the legislature does not have standing as an institutional body. The only way to prevent the governor from violating the law is to come into special session and vote down the violation. And maybe I'll do it again later, but that's the only response that the citizens of Wisconsin have. And that is not correct. The doctrine of taxpayer standing is deliberately broad. We don't need to show a specific injury to Mr. Fabik. If government employees are executing illegal orders, a taxpayer suffers a real injury. It is not required that Section 32310 creates a private cause of action for citizens. We are seeking relief under the Declaratory Judgment Statute. We are seeking a declaration from a court that the governor has violated a statute. And courts interpret statutes. That's what they do. And that's the relief we're seeking.
Counsel, for let me ask you. Oh, go ahead, Justice Bradley. Oh, wait.
Thank you. Don't you need to show a pecuniary loss? And did you advance one in your arguments?
The case law on taxpayer standing, Your Honor, is so broad that we do not need to show a specific dollar amount loss. If government employees, as I said, are executing unlawful orders, that is enough to confer taxpayer standing on Mr. Fabik.
My question, counsel, was not whether or not you had to show a specific amount. My question was whether or not there has to be a showing of a pecuniary loss. Do you have to have a showing of pecuniary loss in order to exercise taxpayer standing? Or, as I understand your argument, being subject to what you think is an illegal order is sufficient to invoke taxpayer standing? I mean, is the second part of that or statement what your position is? Being subjected to an illegal order is sufficient to invoke taxpayer standing?
Our position is that if government employees are carrying out an illegal executive order, that is a misuse of government funds, and that is sufficient to confer taxpayer standing on Mr. Fabik.
Is it sufficient to confer a taxpayer standing if the governor would say, gee, I'm thinking about this, think about it for a while, and the employee, the government employee, spends 3 or 4 hours thinking about it? Is that sufficient to convey taxpayer standing, in your opinion?
In your example, Your Honor, would we be seeking a declaration regarding the governor's thoughts, or what is the plaintiff's?
No. In your brief, and your argument, and in request to have an original action here, you pointed to the idea of the governor directing and asking staff to promulgate certain things, And I interpreted your general argument is that if a employee of the government was spending time in any way advancing an idea, which includes thinking about it, maybe putting pen to paper and writing a little memo on it, that that would be sufficient to invoke taxpayer standing. Is that your position?
If the employee is executing an order that has been issued by the governor, yes, that is our position. That's sufficient to confer
and taxpayer when you standing. And when you say order, are you talking, I'm talking about not a technical term, but the vernacular. And the governor says, take a look at this. Is that sufficient to convey taxpayer standing if as a result of that order, if you will, or directive or request or whatever you want to call it, is that sufficient to invoke taxpayer standing?
I'm not sure what the plaintiff in that scenario is challenging, Your Honor. Could you clarify what the lawsuit, this hypothetical lawsuit, is about?
Justice Karofsky, I yield.
Ms. Fernald, I'm curious as to whether or not you know if Mr. Fabik was a taxpayer in Wisconsin in the autumn and winter of 2013 and 2014.
That is not in the record, Your Honor. I don't know.
So let me ask this then. During that period of time, Governor Walker issued 6 states of emergency, loosening regulatory restrictions on propane transportation. There were supply shortages due to the super, super cold winter. Did Governor Walker, were those orders a violation? He invoked the same statute. Did he act in an unconstitutional manner, as you are alleging here regarding Governor Evers?
Well, we're not arguing a constitutional claim, Your Honor. We're arguing a statutory claim. And I don't know. We don't have any comment on whether those specific orders that you mentioned complied with 32310. There was no legal challenge to any of them. So we have no comment on that. We don't take a position.
Well, I'm interested in what the difference was between those orders that were issued by Governor Walker and the orders that your client is now complaining about that have been issued by Governor Evers. He issued 6 in that time period.
And as I said, Your Honor, none of those were challenged. No one brought a legal challenge to any of those. I don't know the facts surrounding those and whether they complied with the statute. We just are not taking a position on that. We're challenging executive orders 82 and 90, which are before the court right now. And I do want to touch briefly on the non-delegation issue. As the court is aware, we've ceded that portion of the argument to Attorney Essenberg. Our position is the court does not need to reach the constitutional argument. The statutory analysis is clear. This court has a strong preference of avoiding constitutional questions if possible, and that is when there are 2 reasonable interpretations of the statute. Our position is the only reasonable interpretation of the statute here is that the governor has violated it. Circling back to this issue of novelty, because there's been some discussion, and I just want to return to the text of what Governor Evers put in the emergency orders. The first emergency declaration, Emergency Order 72, is relating to a proclamation declaring a health emergency in response to COVID-19 coronavirus. The second and third emergency orders are titled the same, relating to declaring a public health emergency. It was the governor's decision to declare it a public health emergency and to invoke those powers under the statute and delegate the response to his DHS secretary. The question of whether the virus is novel, that would maybe be relevant in a factual determination of whether coronavirus meets the definition. That is not the issue before the court. We take no issue with the first emergency order declaration. We believe it did meet the definition and it was validly issued. Our position is that—
Counsel, since you point to the words of the executive order, let's take a look at those words. Executive Order 90, I'll start with. What are the new, executive order indicates that there are new factors. What are the new factors that were asserted in Executive Order 90 that were not asserted in Executive Order 82?
Well, the governor cited to the rapid growth of the virus, which in our view, it does not make it a new emergency or allow him to extend his powers beyond the 60 days conferred in the statute. The virus grows, the test results will ebb and flow. That doesn't mean it changes into a new public health emergency if the underlying cause remains COVID-19.
What about the new factors that he, new occurrences that he suggested with the commencement of K-12 school and return of students to college and university campuses? Was that asserted in Executive Order 82?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
What about the seasonal changes that's being asserted? In addition, seasonal changes will cause a significant increase and has caused a significant increase. Was that asserted in Executive Order 82?
I don't know. I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
So in conclusion, what Mr. Favik is requesting is for the court to enforce the terms of 32310 and declare that the statute does not allow the governor to unilaterally extend a state of emergency beyond 60 days through the use of successive declarations for the same public health emergency. I see that my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honors.
Yes, thank you, and thank you all for a very good argument and for briefs that are quite helpful to the court as we decide what to do with this latest problem created by COVID-19. We are going to adjourn now. The court will meet in closed conference at 1:00. We are adjourned. Thank you all.